Hi, everyone. I'm Dan Fullerton, physics teacher at Irondequoit High School, and I'm thrilled to welcome you back for the inaugural episode of the 2010-2011 season of the Physics in Action podcast. We've had a busy summer, and we're eager to get back to you with new segments highlighting physics in the world around us, great physicists in history, and new and interesting theories on the frontiers of physics research. This podcast began last year as an experiment to help students learn to transfer what they learn in the classroom to new situations. Its success blew us all away. We set a goal at the beginning of last year of obtaining 100 subscribers by June. By the end of March, we had more than 600 subscribers. To date, the podcast has recorded approximately 80,000 downloads, and even without adding new content over the summer months, we retain a subscribership of 350 listeners. Even better, your feedback and input has enhanced and motivated our students to explore the world of physics well outside the bounds of any defined curricula in our district. Students are actually approaching me asking for research projects so they can do their own podcast episodes. Our APC physics students read theoretical physics books this summer, of their own choosing, and are reporting on these books in our first few podcasts of the year. Not only that, they're applying what they're learning back in the classroom. On our first day of class, students were relating the basic motion equations we reviewed to the relativistic principles and space-time theories they learned about independently over the summer. In short, I'm thrilled with how far we've come. Moving forward, there are always new steps to take. For one, we need to streamline our production workflow. Each episode last year took considerably more time to produce our final product than was spent on the content itself. This year, we'll be involving students more in the editing and production tasks, with the goal of spending a maximum of 50% of our effort on the production. Further, we'd like to increase our collaboration with classes outside of our high school, using listener feedback and interest to provide us direction while learning how to work remotely with other educational entities. And finally, we want to expand our review program from the short 10-minute podcast episodes into another more on-demand format. This will involve taking that information, adding significantly to it, and building a comprehensive physics website that provides students with straightforward, on-demand access to resources that will help them succeed in learning required course content. As you can imagine, this is a very large project, and I anticipate it's actually going to run across several years. But like all such endeavors, you can't complete what you don't start. Before I introduce this episode's segments, allow me to take one more moment to thank you for all your support of our podcast. When you start your Amazon shopping by clicking on the Amazon icon on our physicsinaction.com website, Amazon returns a small portion of their proceeds to the generating website, us. These funds help me to offset the cost of the equipment and resources used in our Physics in Action podcast, ranging from our internet hosting fees to how-to books such as the Great Podcasting for Dummies series to the digital recorder we use in all our episodes and that you're hearing the results of right now. Every little bit helps. Just remember that if you're off to search the Amazon website, try starting off at www.physicsinaction.com and clicking on the Amazon icon on the right-hand side of the page. Your prices remain the same, but it helps us defray the costs incurred in the production of this program. Thank you so much for your support. And with that, I'm pleased to introduce today's segments. First, Will provides us an in-depth review of Stephen Hawking's book, The Universe in a Nutshell. This is followed by Chrissy's exploration of the life of Nicholas Copernicus. Thank you so much for your continued support, and enjoy the show.
Hi, I'm Will, and this is the Physics in Action podcast. Today I'm here to talk to you about Stephen Hawking's book, The Universe in a Nutshell. Fairly new as far as Stephen Hawking books go. New York Times bestseller, according to the cover, which is very cool to look at, by the way. And I know what you're thinking. Stephen Hawking is usually pretty bland. He's got a rather poor sense of humor. But in this book, actually, I think most readers who may not even have an idea about what physics or the universe is about will really get a kick out of it, and this is why. When you open the book up, you'll soon find out that it's a physics picture book, more or less. There's a lot of confusing terms, so you're going to have to Google a couple things, because Stephen Hawking goes in and out between incredibly simple and incredibly difficult to understand. But the basis of the book is centered around these images that he gives you to explain in detail each concept that he presents you with. The book has approximately 7 chapters, not including the glossary, And it's a pretty general overview of the entire universe, so the title lends itself to that, of course. But sometimes you just don't get what the title lends itself to. First chapter, Brief History of Relativity. Very interesting, all about Albert Einstein and his general and specific special theory of relativity. A little bit of quantum theory, too. No string theory, sorry, guys. As we know, Stephen Hawking loves to talk about black holes, but he doesn't actually do that as much as he usually does in lecture in this book. He goes in a little bit of detail, admittedly, but when he does, there's always a picture to explain what he's talking about. He talks about how general relativity discusses the expanding of the universe, the bending of light as it passes by a mass in space, and general physics concepts as well, like a falling elevator accelerating downward or upwards on a constant speed. There's no force, F equals ma. Also a little bit about radiation. He backs Einstein up, you know, because he feels Einstein was not responsible for Hiroshima, etc. He also talks about the Michelson-Morley experiment, an important experiment that determined that there's actually no ether that light travels through, because we suspected prior to the Michelson-Morley experiment that light was a wave, and that just ain't so. I think the most interesting chapter in the whole book is probably the chapter about the shape of space-time. It gets a little bit difficult to understand even with his illustrations, but just the same, they're wonderful. And if you read and reread, you'll still understand everything. It takes like maybe 30 minutes or an hour, depending on how quick you are. One of the more interesting discussions he has in this chapter is about imaginary time, a concept which I still fully don't understand. But the bottom line is that there's several different possibilities of the universe we live in. And he has interesting little graphics for each possibility, each conceptual possibility of the universe. And basically the universe's expansion over time looks like a giant Pope hat upside down. And of course, if the universe time comes to an end, then it looks more like a column with it caps off. So a closed Pope hat upside down. But the point he makes is that due to imaginary time, we can effectively discover what paths our universe might have taken. Obviously, it's a lot of theory. He discusses different dimensions in each different universe, and perfect imaginary time history actually would leave, instead of a Pope hat, it would leave more of a spherical space-time history. And our real-time space history looks more like an upside-down bonnet than a Pope hat. Real-time, he discusses, is being rather globular, as opposed to imaginary time being perfectly spherical. And that's one of the reasons why space-time is so warped, according to Stephen Hawking, as well as masses present in space-time. In this book, he also discusses rather thoroughly the twins paradox, which you may or may not be familiar with, where one twin goes off on a space adventure at the speed of light, and his identical twin stays back home on Earth or whatever his home planet may be. And because less time passes due to the first twin that travels into space moving at the speed of light, when the first twin returns, the second twin will be much, much older. This he also explains, I suppose, in real-life terms, considering the Earth's rotation and taking a clock and a plane, one plane flying west to east, one plane flying east to west, and the time difference that you'll find in those clocks if they leave from the same point and return to the same point. The plane flying west to east apparently has a clock with a shorter time on it. Like I said, if you're interested in nuclear physics, Hawking goes into quite a bit about that. Of course, he was a great fan of Albert Einstein, so he delves into much of Einstein's life and his discoveries. He also discusses the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, pretty thoroughly in this book, which I have to admit, until I read this book, I didn't understand at all. I feel like in this book, Stephen Hawking discusses space-time in a really friendly manner. And of course, the diagrams help, but what he does is a simple graph of space-time, and then he'll explain, you know, what each axis is representing, and he discusses the possibility of intelligent life in another planet, and he actually has a couple different bets as to whether intelligent life exists and will be able to discover it with a few of his colleagues. So that's kind of an interesting rivalry thing to read about. So yeah, I definitely recommend this book by Stephen Hawking. There's, like I said, the rivalry between him and Kip Thorne discussing whether wormholes are possible in this universe. Kip Thorne believes they are, Hawking believes they aren't. With good reason. He doesn't really explain Kip Thorne's side, but that's a different book. He also explains concerning wormholes how it would be, in his eyes, almost impossible to pass through one, because any stray energy would be multiplied to the point where if you passed through the wormhole, you would probably be instantly vaporized. He also talks a little bit about the Big Bang Theory and whether we're, our universe is actually existent on a brain or exists in sort of a holographic state. He describes the formation of a brain world somewhat like a bubble of steam forming in boiling water, which is an interesting comparison that I think is really easy to understand. He discusses blue shift, of course, because he loves that kind of thing, if you're unfamiliar with that. And this being a rather contemporary Stephen Hawking book, he does discuss the LHC, Large Hadron Collider, at Geneva. At the time he was writing the book, it wasn't completed, so he doesn't discuss much more than what it could do. So you can do your own research considering that. But he has some interesting thoughts on the Large Hadron Collider. He discusses not only the formation of black holes, but other singularities, and what makes a black hole different from a specific singularity, as well as the role gravity plays in our universe and how stars and planets would go either spinning into the center of the nearest mass adjacent to them, for us the sun, and burn up, or whether they'd fly off infinitely into space. He also discusses, for those of you that are confused by all the different physics theories, I suppose you'd say, how each theory consistently becomes more specific, and we therefore understand less of the universe, but we understand what we do understand much more. So he describes them in a sort of Russian stacking doll situation, where we have classical physics, where we understand practically nothing, but we have theories for everything. And then more specific, nuclear physics, getting even more specific, atomic physics, and then we have the grand unified theories that Einstein worked on, and then we have, most recently, Planck scale physics, including quantum theory and M-theory. We also get some pretty funny pictures in here. So I'm just going to put that one out there if you enjoy Stephen Hawking's humor. He discusses, of course, Einstein's theory of relativity, which, as he says, agrees with a large number of experiments, and how Einstein discovered, as opposed to the his predecessors who thought that only space was curved, Einstein discovered that space-time must indeed be curved for the universe to exist the way it does. But among the more interesting concepts in the books for me is the concept of 11-dimensional supergravity, which I had heard of before, but again, never really understood into this book, and that's why I enjoyed it so much, reading it over the summer, because I had a lot of time on my hands, and you will need to reread a couple pages of this book, regardless of whether you have an interest in physics or not. But the concept of 11-dimensional supergravity is that the force of gravity, being the weakest of the natural forces, is actually one of the most powerful, but it's spread out over 11 to 12 different dimensions. He does talk quite a bit about M-theory, which I don't understand at all, so I'm not going to talk to you about that, but I still recommend that you read the book yourself. And that's a pretty good summation of Stephen Hawking's The Universe in a Nutshell. Like I said, New York Times bestseller, so check it out. It's a physics picture book for those who have an outrageous interest in physics and for those who are just getting started.
Thanks, Will. And now, here's Chrissy with a segment on the life of Nicholas Copernicus.
Born on February 19, 1473 in Turin, Poland, Nicholas Copernicus was designed to become, through the publication of his heliocentric theory 7 years later, one of the sedimental figures in the history of scientific thought. The son of a prosperous merchant, he was raised with his father's death by a maternal uncle who enabled him to enter the University of Krakow, then famous for its mathematics, philosophy, and astronomy curriculum. This experience stimulated the young Copernicus to study further liberal arts in Bologna, medicine at Padua, and law at University of Ferrara, from which he emerged in 1503 with a doctorate in canon law. Shortly afterward, he returned to Poland and eventually settled permanently in the cathedral from Borg, less than 100 miles from his birthplace. Through his uncle's influence, he had been elected a canon of the church even before his journey to Italy. Copernicus not only faithfully performed his duties, but also practiced medicine, wrote a treatise on monetary reform, and turned his attention to a subject which he had been long interested in, astronomy. By May 15, 1514, Copernicus had written and discreetly circulated a manuscript in his Commentarios, the first outline of those arguments eventually substantiated in On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Spirit, 1543. Copernicus's book summarized his heliocentric theory. It listed the assumptions upon which the theory was based as follows. 1. There was no one center of all celestial circles or spheres. 2. The center of the Earth was not the center of the universe, but only of gravity and the lunar sphere. 3. All spheres revolve around the sun as their midpoint, and therefore the sun is the center of the universe. 4. The ratio of the Earth's distance from the sun and the height of the firmament is so much smaller than the ratio of the Earth's radius to its distance from the sun, then the distance of the Earth to the sun is imperceptible in comparison with the height of the firmament. 5. Whatever motion appears in the firmament arises not from any motion of the firmament, but the Earth's motion. 6. What appears to us as motion of the sun arises not as motion, but from the motion of the Earth in our sphere. And 7. The apparent retrograde and direct motion of the planets arises not from their motion, but from the Earth. The De Revolutionibus itself was divided into 6 parts called books. 1 was the general version of the heliocentric theory and a summarized exposition of his idea of the world. 2, many theories that were presented in that present the principles of spherical astronomy and a list of stars. 3, dedicated to the motions of the sun and related phenomena. 4, description of the moon and its orbital motions. 5, concrete exposition of the new system. This classic work challenged the geocentric cosmetology that had been dogmatically accepted since the time of Aristotle, in direct opposition to Aristotle and the 2G century astronomer Ptolemy, who enunciated the ideas of the geocentric system based on the celestial phenomenon. Copernicus proposed that a rotating Earth revolving with other planets without a stationary central sun could account in a simpler way for the same observed phenomenon of the early rotation of the heavens, the annual movement of the sun through the ecliptic, and the periodic retrograde motion of the planets. The theory by Copernicus marked the beginning of the scientific revolution and of a new view of a greatly enlarged universe. It would shift away from a comfortable anthropocentrism of the ancient and medieval world. A scientific theory that reflected so profoundly on humanity was not welcomed by the church, and it was only after the publication in 1540 of Nurotaro Prima, a first account, by an enthusiastic supporter named Retzius, that the aged Copernicus agreed to commit to print the theory already outlined in 1514. An undocumented but often repeated story holds that Copernicus received a printed copy of his treatise on his deathbed. He died on May 24th, 1543.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'd love to hear your feedback. Feel free to contact us by leaving feedback on our iTunes webpage or send us an email at physicsinactionpodcast@gmail.com. And of course, you can always visit our website at www.physicsinaction.com. Intro and exit music is Tech by For Me to See, brought to you courtesy of Mevio's Music Alley. Check it out at music.mevio.com and make it a great day, everyone.